Okay, so I'm going to talk about how integrability can help make null canonical gravity more amenable to quantization. Okay, so this is partly joint work with Andreas Fuchs, who was my master's student, and here, well. So I'm going to start by telling you what I mean, at least, by canonical vacuum general relativity in terms of free, that is, unconstrained initial data on null hypersurfaces. And then I'm going to show you the Poisson brackets of these free data. Okay. And then I'm going to show you also the Poisson brackets in the case of cylindrical symmetry. Okay. And we're going to see that the full Poisson algebra is essentially a direct sum of an infinity of copies of the cylindrically symmetrical Poisson algebra. Now, the cylindrically symmetric vacuum general relativity is an integral system, and a quantization is known at the algebraic level. That means that an exact specification of all commutators has been given. So this seems like a good step toward quantizing the full null canonical Poisson algebra without cylindrical symmetry. Okay, but the variables that are quantized in the cylindrically symmetrical case are not the same free null initial data that I will present at the beginning. Okay, so we're going to discuss the transformation to these new also free data, which have a known quantization at this algebraic level. Okay, we must look at I'm going to show you the Poisson brackets of these new data. I'm going to outline what's known about the quantization of these. And finally, I'm going to show what has been done so far of pulling this result back to the full symmetry-less case. Okay. And then finally, I'm going to close with some directions for future work. In fact, directions of my current work. So here we go. Okay, so in this approach to canonical gravity, the initial data hypersurfaces are so-called double null sheets. These are pairs of intersecting null hypersurfaces, also called light fronts in some parts of the literature. Okay, and they intersect and they form something that you could say looks like an open book in space-time. Okay, here's a picture of one of these double null sheets in 2+1 dimensional space-time. So everything here is reduced by one dimension from the 3+1 case that I'm most interested in. Here is the same double null sheet, but in 3+1 dimensional space-time, but I haven't shown the embedding. So all the parts are there, but they're not embedded in the space-time. In particular, so the double null sheet consists of two null hypersurfaces, or two branches, n left and n right. And these are three surfaces swept out by the null geodesics that emerge normally toward the future from the two sides of a two-dimensional disk. Here's the S0. Okay? These null geodesics are called the generators of the two null hypersurfaces. Okay. Now, so that's the initial data hypersurface. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the free initial data on these hypersurfaces. And to define these free initial data, I have to give you some coordinates. Okay, and the coordinates I will use are the following. So here's a picture of one of the branches, the right branch of the double null sheet. Okay, and one end of this branch is the disk S0, and it's truncated at another disk SR before any of the generators cross or form caustics. Okay, so on S0, I choose two coordinates, theta 1 and theta 2, as I like. And I then hold these constant on each of the generators. So these coordinates label the generators. I now have two coordinates for my three-dimensional coordinate system already defined. What I need to finish it is a parameter that parameterizes each one of the generators. Okay, there you can actually choose many, but one that I've used a lot is something that's sometimes called the luminosity distance. It's a parameter that's it's defined so that the cross-sectional area of an infinitesimal bundle of neighboring generators, here's the, well, not quite infinitesimal in the drawing, obviously, a bundle of neighboring generators, the cross-sectional area of this bundle is proportional to the parameter squared. And I also set the parameter, this parameter V, to 1 at S0. So that defines the parameter completely. Okay. This particular parameterization doesn't work in some cases. For instance, if S0 were a plane in Minkowski space, then the cross-sectional areas would be constant and this wouldn't work. But generically, it does work. Okay? And if it doesn't, one could substitute with some other parameterization. Okay. Oh, and I truncate this branch, this null branch, soon enough that so that this parameter is monotonic along the generators. Okay. So that's the coordinate system. What are the initial data? The free initial data. You might already know that free initial data on this sort of null hypersurface was already found in the early 1960s by Sachs, Daucourt, and others. So the data consists of two types. One type of data is the so-called bulk data. That's defined on the entire three manifolds, the left and the right branch. Okay, and the other type of data is surface data, which live only on the intersection two surface, on the intersection disk S0. Okay, we're going to concentrate on the bulk data, but I mentioned all the data here. Okay, so what is the bulk data? In my scheme, which is a variant of that of Sachs, it is the conformal two metric on these null three surfaces and these cylinders here. Okay, the conformal three metric is two metric. Sorry, is defined in the following way. Well, first of all, you have to It's basically the induced, the conformal induced geometry. The line element on one of these null hypersurfaces is in fact a two-dimensional sort of line element, because since the tangents to the generators are both tangent to the surface, normal to the surface and null, there is no dv term in the line element. So the only terms are d theta terms. So if you write out the line element, you have a 2x2 matrix here and d theta A, d theta B. Okay. So this is, in fact, this HAB can be interpreted as a Riemannian metric, which is the induced metric on cross sections of this null hypersurface, which are transverse to the generators. Okay, so it's just because it's a null hypersurface that the induced metric has this two-dimensional form. Okay, so then I take this two by two matrix of metric components, and I divide it by the square root of its determinant, and that gives me what I call the conformal two metric. It's again symmetric 2x2 matrix, which now has determinant 1. Okay, so since it's symmetric 2x2, determinant 1, it has only 2 real degrees of freedom per point, and one can parameterize it at each point by single complex number. So this is a nice way to do that. Actually, this is a known parameterization. These are so-called Beltrami coefficients, these mu's. Okay. So this is a generalization of the familiar parameterization of familiar way of writing the metric on the Euclidean plane as dz by dz bar. You put complex coordinates on the Euclidean plane, and then you can write the Euclidean metric as dz by dz bar. Well, here we put, again, a complex coordinate on S0. Well, we replace theta 1 and theta 2 with a complex coordinate, theta 1 plus I theta 2. And we want to now express this line element here in terms of dz and dz bar. But because it's not Euclidean metric, it's curved, there will be a dz by dz bar term, but also dz bar terms, and dz, dz terms. And this can all be, in general, written in this form with a coefficient mu for the dz bar term and the complex conjugate mu bar for the dz term, and an overall coefficient which turns out to be rho, this determinant of the square root of the determinant of the Riemannian metric, which is, you can also see as the area density on these cross sections of the null hypersurface, the cross sections transverse to the generators. Okay, and another factor, which is just a function of mu and mu bar. So now, if we divide HAB by rho, or the square root of its determinant, then of course we're left with something that depends only on mu and mu bar. So we've managed to take all the information in EAB, in E, and package it into this complex number. Okay, so that's the bulk datum. Okay. And the surface data are, there are 4 of them. Rho 0 is just the area density, but restricted to the intersection 2 surface, the disk, that on the intersection of the two null hypersurfaces. Lambda is a datum more or less conjugate to rho 0, and tau, the twist, is a two-component one-form field on S0. Okay, so that's the data. The Poisson brackets for these free data, these are free data, right? So there are no constraints. Right? Any valuation of these data, to any valuation that corresponds a solution or a Cauchy development, and of course, any Cauchy development defines these data. So the only reason I show you all this, these are all the non-zero brackets, is to make this point that the brackets are, sufficiently simple that they can be written on one page, but also rather sufficiently complicated that it's not evident immediately how one would go about quantizing the system. Okay, so let's concentrate just on the brackets of the bulk data. Okay, so here they are. mu at one point with mu at another point gives zero. And mu bar at one point commutes with mu bar at every other point. The non-trivial bracket, the non-zero bracket, is between mu at one point and mu bar at another point. I just use the numbers 1 and 2 to label points. I don't want to go into all the details of this. But here, h is a step function that's 1 if the point 2 follows the point 1 as you go along the generator from the intersection surface. Okay, and 0 otherwise. And notice the most important thing of all, that there's a delta function, a delta distribution here, that says that the bracket is 0 unless the two points are at the on the same generator. Okay. So this is an important point. What this means is that if we were, for instance, to make a numerical simulation of this, or you want to somehow discretize this, then we would replace this delta, Dirac delta, with a Kronecker delta with some normalization factor. And then literally we would have that the Poisson algebra, this subalgebra at least, is simply the sum of Poisson algebras of the data on the same generator, right? Now, this doesn't exactly work in this case because this is, of course, a delta distribution. And so if you set really theta 1 equal to theta 2, it just is meaningless. But morally, this algebra is a sum of Poisson algebras without this delta and all of the mu and mu bar on the same living on the same generator. There's also another little strange thing here that this, well, maybe I shouldn't mention that. We can come back to it later. Okay. Okay. So a step toward quantization would be to quantize this one generator algebra. Okay, so here it's written again. I've just taken out the delta, replaced it by a normalizing value. So instead of the Newton's constant, I have here a G prime. Okay, and otherwise, it's exactly the same. And of course, now the fields, these mu and mu bar, live all on one single line. Okay, now these are, fortunately, this algebra, which would be very interesting to quantize. Oh, I should say that this decomposition into one generator algebras extends to the whole Poisson algebra. And in fact, you can see that it would have to be that way. Maybe I even mentioned it here. Yeah, points on distinct generators are space-like separated. Okay, so one would expect that the Poisson brackets between data at these points would be 0. Well, they're not causally related. OK, so fortunately, this one generator algebra, which it would seem to be a good thing to quantize, is not some arbitrary construction. It turns out to be precisely the Poisson algebra of the same data in the cylindrically symmetric case. Okay, so I have a cylindrically symmetric space-time. And I define a special double null sheet adapted to the cylindrical symmetry. Okay, it's made up of generators that are geodesics, that null geodesics that go radially from the symmetry axis. Okay, and S0 here, the intersection surface, is a piece of one of the symmetry orbits. Here I've made a picture of the situation. I've suppressed a cylindrical symmetry, right? Has an axial symmetry and a translation symmetry. So I've just suppressed the dimension that's swept out by the translation killing vector, right? So I'm just so that takes me down to three dimensions. The axial symmetry becomes just a rotational symmetry, and this line here is the world. Well, it's the really, it represents the world sheet of the symmetry axis. But now that I've suppressed one dimension, it's just a world line of the symmetry point of this rotational symmetry. Okay, and g prime here now has to be g divided by the Newton's constant divided by theta coordinate area of S0 for this to work. Okay. So, okay, so cylindrically symmetrical. So now we see that what I said in the outline at the beginning, that in some sense the Poisson algebra of the free null initial data is simply a sum of Poisson algebras of the free null initial data of the same data for cylindrically symmetrical gravity. Okay. Now, fortunately, cylindrically symmetric GR is an integrable system. It has a huge symmetry group, the Gerosch group, and which is in fact transitive. And so, in a sense, the phase space must be some sort of homogeneous space associated with this symmetry group. So it has a lot of structure, a lot of algebraic structure, and a quantization at the algebraic level exists that was published by Korotkin and Samtliv in 1998. Okay. Now, but in this quantization, they do not quantize mu and mu bar, these variables that I've used to define the Poisson brackets, but rather some other variables. And so as to be able to use their result, we have to, and to relate it to the variables that we have an interpretation of, we have to transform, we have to define the transformation from mu and mu bar to these other variables, which I take to be, they use slightly different ones, but it's essentially the same. Something, this epsilon, which I gave the rather awkward name of the deformed conformal metric. Okay. Okay. So I'll just now briefly outline the steps for this transformation. So first of all, we want to go from mu to a new field V, which is a Zweibein for the conformal 2 metric on the symmetry orbits. Now recall that the In this special double null sheet, the surfaces of constant parameter v along the generators are all pieces of the cylindrical symmetry orbits. So EAB, this Our conformal 2 metric is the conformal 2 metric on the symmetry orbits that pass through the initial data surface. Okay, and we can invent a we can write down a Zweibein for this. Okay, by this definition, this is okay. And one possible Zweibein we can use, defined by mu and mu bar, is this one. This is basically obtained by demanding that the Zweibein be upper triangular, and the trace be positive or something like that. I don't remember. Yeah, I think so. That was the condition. The other one. From now on, we will only treat one branch of this double null sheet, which is the branch this and left, which touches the symmetry axis. Okay, and in the presentation here, I will assume that this Zweibein and therefore the conformal 2 metric is regular at the axis, at the symmetry axis. That actually means that in the four metric in the original cylindrically symmetrical spacetime is not regular there, but that doesn't worry me. I don't really want to study the cylindrically symmetrical spacetime. It's simply a model for the one generator Poisson algebra for the non-symmetric spacetime. Okay, now here's the key step in going to the new variables. I deform this Zweibein. And the deformation is of a very particular sort. You define a flat connection, which is just V inverse dV. From this flat connection, well, the fact that it's flat doesn't matter because we're just using it in one-dimensional context here. From this connection, one can recover the original Zweibein the following way. You say it's equal to the Zweibein at a point y is equal to the Zweibein at the point where the initial data hypersurface touches the symmetry axis, 0. Okay, so at V0 times the path-ordered exponential of this connection. And this allows you to reconstruct the Zweibein. Okay? Here I'm using path-ordered exponential ordered from left to right, which is the opposite of what's used a lot in physics. Okay, but that's just a detail. I could have written it all backward. Okay. Now, so I have this connection which captures most of the information in V, except for V0. And this connection is, it's a one form and it's a 2x2 matrix. 2x2 matrix valued one form. I can take the symmetric piece of it and the anti-symmetric piece. Okay. Now, I'm now going to define the deformed connection, which will let us define a deformed Zweibein. The deformed connection has the same anti-symmetric piece, but the symmetric piece is multiplied by a factor, it's written here, which depends on an additional point. So the connection here is a one-form field with argument x, but it has an additional dependence on what I call the deformation point, which is y. Okay, so this is a function which starts out at 1 at the symmetry axis and blows up at this point y. Okay, but in an integrable way. Okay, so now I can take this deformed connection and construct a deformed Zweibein, simply following exactly the same procedure that I used to define the original Zweibein from the original connection. I just set it to be equal to V at the axis, the undeformed V, times the path-ordered exponential, but now the deformed connection. And I take this integral precisely to the point, to the deformation point. So I now have, again, a function of only one point on the null hypersurface here. Okay, so that was the key point. Now, what's the deformed conformal metric? Well, it's just a conformal metric defined using the deformed Zweibein in place of the original one. So I just say it's V hat times V hat transpose. Now, here's something I'm not going to discuss. This map is actually invertible modulo a certain mode that I hadn't mentioned before, but in unphysical degree of freedom of the original data. So it's actually somewhat better than the original data. It gets rid of something that shouldn't have been there. And to give some intuition of what it is, I can tell you one little fact about it. If I have the deformed conformal two metric at this point y, then on solutions, that is equal to the conformal two metric at a point on the symmetry axis which lies on the past light cone of the point y. Okay, this is, I mean, stated like this is just a miracle, but it's true, and well, it gives you some idea maybe of what it means. Okay, so that's the transformation, the new free initial data that replaces mu, or the undeformed conformal two-metric. So what's the Poisson algebra of these new variables? Well, it's not completely simple, but actually quite nice, somewhat nicer than that of the mu's. What is it? Here I have two components of the deformed conformal two-metric at the point one, Poisson bracket with the other components of the deformed conformal two-metric at point two, and that's equal to, well, a prefactor times this quadratic in the two conformal, deformed conformal two metrics symmetrized over interchange of AB and interchange of CD, okay? The prefactor is 64 pi, the modified Newton's constant, times the Cauchy principal value of 1 over rho at the point 1 minus rho at the point 2. The Cauchy principal value is a distribution. You might know that 1 over x by itself doesn't define a distribution. If you multiply 1 over x by a smooth function and integrate it by a test function, you don't get a well-defined result. No? But if you regularize the integral, you cut off the integral near the origin, and take the limit as your cutoff goes to 0, then you can get a well-defined result, but you can do this in various different ways and get different answers. So the Cauchy principal value is obtained, well, the Cauchy principal value contracted with a test function is the integral of 1 over x times the test function from minus infinity to minus epsilon, plus the integral from epsilon to infinity of the same integrand, and then you take the limit, the symmetric limit, as epsilon goes to 0. So it's actually important, because otherwise this would not be a distribution in the two argument points. So it's important that it's this principal value and not just some unspecified regularization of 1 over rho 1 minus rho 2. Okay, so this is nicer than the original bracket in one way, that in that it depends only on the fields at the two points 1 and 2, and not at intermediate points as the original bracket did. And of course, this does turn out to be precisely a bracket that Korotkin and Samtleben quantized at the algebraic level. So here's an outline of the quantization. I don't expect you to understand all this in detail. I don't expect anything. You can do whatever you want, obviously. There's no exam. But it's just to give an idea what we have. So you can form What they presented was an associative algebra that quantizes this Poisson algebra of the epsilons. You can form polynomials in these epsilons, and you can define the. For instance, you could take polynomials with epsilons with the argument points ordered along the null hypersurface along the generator. And then you can multiply these, because you have an exchange relation that allows you to exchange the order of two arguments. So I don't know if you, this is something that's not unusual in integrable systems theory. These R's are R matrices. I have here epsilon 1 is a tensor in the tangent space at the space 1. Epsilon 2 is another tensor in the tangent space at the point 2. And r and r prime are tensors in the product of these two tangent spaces. So you can carry out these multiplications. Here are the explicit expressions for the r's. They're not terribly complicated. Aq is the Planck, 8 pi times the Planck area. Delta is the difference between the areas of the cylindrically of the intersections of the cylindrical symmetry orbits with the null surface n left that pass through points 1 and 2, respectively. Okay. Okay, so also epsilon is, the matrix is also at the quantum level is symmetrical, and the components are supposed to be self-adjoint. Okay. Finally, in the classical theory, the determinant of the deformed conformal 2 metric, like the original conformal 2 metric, is 1. So one would like to implement that in the quantization. Korotkin and Sandleben give a quantization of this condition, but actually their work is carried out entirely in an asymptotically flat context, whereas I don't make any assumption about asymptotically flatness. And their statement that the determinant of epsilon is 1 is a statement about asymptotic quantities. So it's possible that one could reformulate the statement in terms of non-asymptotic quantities, but I haven't managed to do it so far. Okay, so there's one piece of the algebraic quantization which doesn't carry over to my situation here. Okay, so the algebra of these quantum data is known, but although Korotkin and Sandleben originally proposed a unitary representation, a representation that would implement this relation that the components of the quantum deformed conformal 2 metric should be self-adjoint, they weren't actually able to prove that it was self-adjoint. And I suppose it must be very difficult because in all these years it hasn't been done. They made some further efforts, but they didn't do it. Okay, so the whole idea now with this was to take these results of the cylindrically symmetric theory and somehow bring them back to the general non-symmetric theory. Well, so to what extent can this be done? Well, hopefully it can be done entirely, but I'll show you what has been easy to do so far. Okay. It's quite straightforward to do it at the classical level. The transformation from these free initial data mu to the deformed conformal 2 metric works perfectly well in the general case, simply as a transformation of the data on each generator. Okay, and you get, essentially, by the same calculation, you get a fairly simple Poisson bracket, which is the same as the Poisson bracket you saw earlier for epsilon. But now there's a delta, again indicating that only data on the same generator have a non-zero bracket, and instead of the modified Newton's constant, there's the standard Newton's constant here. So basically, you take the same Poisson bracket and you multiply it by delta, Dirac delta times a normalizing constant. You can also formally generalize the quantization. That amounts to replacing everywhere the modified Newton's constant by the unmodified Newton's constant times a Dirac delta. The problem is that in this exchange relation is not linear in Newton's constant. So you get products of deltas. So it's ambiguous. Something further has to be done to disambiguate it. Okay. So finally, some things to do. One thing that would be nice to do is to finally implement this as condition that the determinant of the quantum deformed conformal two metric be one. I mean, the tricky part for implementing is, of course, that it has to be compatible with the algebra that already exists. The condition. Another thing to do is to study representations of this algebra in general, and there's a simplified model of cylindrically symmetric gravity where you put a condition on the polarization of the gravitational waves in this cylindrically symmetric universe, and that has been studied in more detail and quantized. Well, Kukash did somehow considered the founding work on the quantization of this simplified theory in 1971, and then there's further work by many people. So that's another thing that one could do to get a handle on the representation problem. Here's an issue that I'm working on now with another graduate student and a collaborator, and that is. So far, in all of this, I've only discussed the bulk data. But there were other data that live on the two-surface S0, the intersection two-surface of the two null hypersurfaces. And they are also present in the cylindrically symmetrical model. They were ignored by Korotkin and Samtleb, and they just took a reduced model that didn't include these data. But you can, it's still integrable with these data included. And so it would be nice to be able to play this whole game and get a larger algebra, which again, following more or less the lead of the work of Korotkin and Samtleb, one could at least at an algebraic level quantize. So the two data the data on the intersection two surface that I'm working on with my collaborators is the area density on the intersection two surface and this conjugate variable or quasi conjugate variable. This would be very interesting to resolve this problem because with this included, one could start to ask whether the holographic conjecture is realized in some quantization because this area density on the intersection two surface, once it's quantized, allows you to construct a quantum area operator for the intersection two surface. And so, you can ask whether the dimension of the Hilbert space or Hilbert subspace associated with some eigenvalue of this area operator is bounded by the exponential of the area in Planck units, which is more or less one expression of the holographic conjecture.
Sorry?
Yeah?
When you equalize the cylindrical model,
which
is what is the dimension of the
Hilbert
space?
Without the rho zero.
Just one generator. What is the dimension?
They have no dimension because they didn't find a representation. They have no Hilbert space. They just have an operator algebra that's consistent.
So is there evidence that
I would be surprised if it were. I think, you could say, How could it be simpler to quantize a larger algebra than a smaller algebra? Because the subalgebra is, of course, the quantization of the subalgebra is included in the quantization of the larger algebra. But really, when you quantize, you make some additional assumptions which might seem natural in the context of the smaller algebra, but don't seem so natural in the context of the larger algebra. So I'm hoping not to get the same quantization as they, but something similar. And then maybe if I can state the condition that the dimensionality should be less than a certain bound, then I can look for a representation with that characteristic.
If the larger algebra has a finite dimensional representation, then there should exist finite dimensional representation of the subalgebra.
Right, but that only if the subalgebra is really the same. So if the quantization of Korotkin and Samtleben is really a subalgebra of the quantization of the larger algebra, then yes.
Okay.
But I think I've gotten a lot of out of this work of Korotkin and Samtleben, but I think it's tapped out in the sense that no one has been able to find a representation all this time. It's true, of course, only the authors have been really pushing that, but they had lots of motivation to do it. They're very capable people, and many years after, they haven't done it. So I think there must be something very, very hard there. At least very hard, or maybe impossible. I don't know. Okay. So of course the overall aim then is to use the results from cylindrically symmetrical GR to quantize the data then in full GR. Okay, so that's it.
A couple of related questions. Rather than taking the plane and the generators back and forth in two null directions, could you just take a point and quantize and discuss the null cone of a point?
Well, it's something I chose not to try. Maybe it could be done, but it's the vertex of a null cone is a very complicated thing in this approach. Mm-hmm. You have to put a large collection of complicated conditions on the fields. And I guess I wanted also to get at this holographic principle in this Busso form, where you have a null sheet. It has a base cross section, and you want the Hilbert space to somehow have a dimension bounded by the exponential of the area of this cross section.
Well, but let me push you a little bit. I mean, it's not a discussion about whether one is more Wolffian than the other. If one takes your S0,
mm-hmm.
and compactifies it into a little two-sphere, and then shrink that two-sphere down, and then essentially you would have in the linear case the light before light cone of an event.
Certainly classically that's true. Just wonder if quantum fluctuations wouldn't then make the little two-sphere big again.
Well, maybe it's worth trying. If you could, my next step, if you could do that, you could maybe do a causal diamond. And then you would have something which was a compact, self-contained region of classical quantum geometry that you could do some interesting things with.
Yeah, sure. Sure, yeah, you could do that. I think it would be very difficult, but...
What you're doing is very difficult, but you're managing...
But I think it would be even more difficult. I don't know.
Well, if you do it the way you're doing it, that you want to have a complete description of a domain, you have to put boundaries on it. And have you considered all the possibility that there are outer boundaries?
Well, there is.
Before cost is formed.
Right.
But you didn't consider the possibility of degrees of freedom on that boundary, or dynamics of those degrees of freedom on the boundary.
Yeah, actually, I have. I didn't mention them, but it's something I haven't really worked out. There were some further degrees of freedom which I didn't mention, which perhaps are degrees of freedom of the boundary. But I must say I don't understand them at all. Yeah, I certainly that's an unexplored area. There are, for instance. Not all diffeomorphisms are gauged. There are certain diffeomorphisms which there are boundary terms in the symplectic two form which makes certain diffeomorphisms non-gauge.
Well,
and I don't know what to.
I know.
Just a follow-up on this question. So what you are quantizing is like one initial hypersurface. But in order to understand that dynamics, you would be interested in like transition amplitudes between an initial hypersurface and a finite hypersurface.
Yeah.
Or is it not?
Or some sort of evolution, yeah. Yeah, so, that's something I'd like to do. Jurek asked me about that, and I think it's not terribly, well, not undoably difficult to work out a Hamiltonian for sliding one of these hypersurfaces up along the other one. So you would certainly, I mean, this is that brings us to another important point. This is very much a gauge-fixed formalism, but you would want any quantization to respect some things, like if you evolve in two different ways to get data on a new hypersurface in the domain of dependence, you would want the quantizations of the two data to be unitarily equivalent or something like that, which would probably put a strong constraint on what you can do in the quantization. That's sort of a remnant of diffeomorphism invariance that would be in the formalism.
I just have a comment. There are papers by Sean Hayward trying to come up with a Hamiltonian that generates that kind of evolution. But what he found is that it's not a Hamiltonian in the honest sense at all. That in some sense, like omega of x is not pH. So it doesn't, for some reason, have any simple interpretation in terms of the normal Hamiltonian. So it's something a bit more bizarre. I mean, maybe he was just doing it wrong or something.
I don't know. Maybe I have seen, but if I've seen them, I've forgotten these papers of Sean. So
yeah, that was something that, I mean, I don't know, maybe quantum mechanically it doesn't matter so much. But he did have a whole formalism for how to deal with the mechanics of these kinds of things.
Oh, great.
Yeah, which is.
Well, no, that's a great help for me. I haven't really started. I mean, there is a one problem, and that's that. Of course, if you slide one of these null sheets up along the other one, the part of it that's inside the domain of dependence of the original pair of null surfaces will get smaller and smaller. So it's not a usual Hamiltonian evolution where your initial state determines the complete final state. But it looks like you should be able to put the differential equation giving the evolution at one point in the interior of the domain of dependence into a sort of a Hamiltonian form.
Pair of Hamiltonian and one per each direction, but then something strange happens when you have to think about the left derivative. There has to be some integrability condition between these two.
You think
about the left derivative of the right one and vice versa, and this is what led to the seemingly non-Hamiltonian matrices.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Continuing a little bit with this question, you are only dealing with part of space-time because you're completing these things, and probably it would be natural to try to extend it with similar constructions repeated in many places to kind of cover a bigger region. And so, if I understood Lee correctly, you would have this copy of your book, and then put the other copies more toward the future and try to see about self-intersections. And then you could try to see what happens in a bounded four-dimensional region that is supposed to be compatibly described by all these parts of books.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there you will find that the classical levels are more restrictions that are related to this degrees of freedom that you're not. You are neglecting some part of the degrees of freedom, the ones that are in the outer boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the inner boundary of some other construction. And so maybe you can get some refined algebra in the classical level that gives you some more information.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it should be possible. In fact, if you wanted to. Express the field equations in this formalism, you would want to give something like compatibility condition between the initial data on intersecting pairs of null hypersurfaces or just single hypersurfaces. And that would give you so that would be, I think, the way to express the dynamics in a general case with this Hamiltonian form of sliding one surface up. Another one would be just a special case. I don't know. The boundary degrees of freedom, there's things that look I suppose there would ultimately be something like quasi-local energy momentum. There are things that look sort of like momentum and energy things there. So that, I'm sure, would enter. But I mean, this is something I haven't explored in detail at all. So,
well, if there are no further questions,
I have a more technical question. The conformal metric, that's sort of the configuration that
No, it's the phase space variable. It's both configuration.
So it's also the
dimension. It makes up almost all of the data. Then there are just data on S0. It's a situation that arises in all null or characteristic formulations. I mean, if you take the scalar field, free scalar field, then just the value of the scalar field on such a null hypersurface provides you a complete phase space coordinates, unlike the case in a space-like Cauchy surface where that's just half. You know, it's just the configuration variable. And
it's because you have four spook sheets. If you have only one, then you would have to specify.
Yes, that's right.
So if you have four, then you have set over.
Okay.
Well then, let's thank Michael again.
Okay. Thanks.